political, you know, conglomeration. And so this was actually a major concession that McCarthy had to make during his speaker fight. It was one of the things that some of the far right Republicans who were echoing calls from the right wing media were demanding, and he conceded to that. So the reason that it even happened is that the right wing media pushed a few of their big sort of Republican leaders to then make this an issue during the speaker fight. He conceded. So that's how we got here, is that it was sort of a creature of the right wing media.
And we have 30 seconds.
What it means is that it's an official rewrite. It's an official rewrite of what happened on January 6th, and they're using Tucker Carlson as sort of the chief storyteller of that new version of what took place there. And I think we all know what it's going to be. It's going to be lies and conspiracies that it was a false flag pushed by the Democrats and the news media.
And the fact that this is the people's footage, I mean, this is the footage of the Capitol being handed to this private corporation?
Yeah, and it's not being done in a transparent way. It feels much more transactional to me than transparent.
Well, Angela Carasone, we want to thank you so much for being with us. President of Media Matters, which recently sent a Federal Elections Commission complaint against Fox News based on evidence from the Dominion $1.6 billion lawsuit. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO is hiring a full-time web coordinator. The web coordinator maintains the front end of KBOO's website, promotes episodes, does copy editing, and helps train staff and volunteers on various website features. For the full job description and instructions for applying, please go to our website at kboo.fm/webhire23. Applications are due at midnight on Thursday, March 9th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers consider a bill to help protect students with disabilities in the public school system. A rash of car theft scams target concerned drivers around Portland. And a report reveals hundreds of thousands of Twitter bots propping up former President Donald Trump's public perception. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 6, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola. Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill that would help students with disabilities get proper public education. Oregon Bill 819 would change the abbreviated school day program requirements in Oregon's public schools. The abbreviated day program has impacted hundreds of students with disabilities who have been unlawfully sent home early or for extended periods of time without due process. Bill 819 will require that parents or foster advocates must give informed and written consent, and schools must provide documentation for modifying a student's schedule. But the passage of this bill into law remains far from certain. Owen Bastable reports.
On February 7th, Senate Bill 819 was discussed in an Education Committee hearing chaired by State Senator Michael Dembro. The bill was sponsored by Democratic Senator Sarah Gelzer Bluen and proposes to make significant changes to Oregon's abbreviated day program. The abbreviated day program went into effect in 2017 for students with disabilities in Oregon schools. The program allows for shortening a student's day for an extended period of time. But since this program started, Tom Stenson, Deputy Legal Director for Disability Rights Oregon, has found that many schools are not using the abbreviated day program as it was intended.
It's been extensively documented and you know, very clearly stated that there's a massive problem of kids being on shortened school days completely inappropriate.
During the Education Committee hearing, several parents of Oregon students provided public testimony of their personal experiences with the abbreviated day program. Emily Perkel spoke about her experiences with her son.
Our very bright, curious, and kind 9-year-old autistic child has been struggling in our local school district since kindergarten. From the beginning, I was consistently asked to come to the school to help support him, essentially becoming his unpaid one-to-one adult support. We then put him on an abbreviated school day for the latter part of kindergarten.
Over the next few years, Emily's son continued to struggle. He was moved in and out of two specialized classrooms. By third grade, Emily reported the school started to use restraints to manage her son's behaviors.
During this time, we did not receive any official documentation related to these restraints. We did get the occasional phone call or email indicating the teacher had to hold him a few times or put him in the peace room. This is what they call the de-escalation or isolation room.
This January, just 2 weeks before she shared her story with the Oregon Education Committee, Emily decided to withdraw her son from school and homeschool him. This also resulted in her having to leave her job as a special education teacher in a school district.
We agreed to the placement only because we thought we could get more support. In a small light at the end of this dark tunnel, he finally started home instruction 2 weeks ago, and it's been a very positive experience. It's only 5 hours a week, but we'll take it. He can learn in a setting where he feels safe while we wait to find out what happens next.
As it turns out, Emily's son's story is not uncommon in Oregon schools, with at least 1,000 documented cases where students have been blocked from obtaining the education they are guaranteed under law. It is also not a new issue, with a pending lawsuit and over 10 years of concerns shared by parents and advocates seeking to address and modify the use of this practice in schools. Here's State Senator Sarah Gelzer Bluen, who is the lead sponsor of Senate Bill 819.
So Senate Bill 819 is a long time coming. It's an issue that I have been working on for more than a decade. I actually found an email when I was cleaning out my email box the other day from 14 years ago.
State Senator Gelzer Bluen started to notice a pattern of schools sending students home for unclear reasons, which she referred to as informal removals.
I started to hear from advocates about what at the time was called informal removals. And these were kids who were not suspended or expelled from school, but they were just kind of gently sent home or told not to come back, or they would parents would be called to pick them up early or bring them late, or you know, just come a couple of days a week.
With limited information or data on this practice, Senator Gelzer Bluen reached out to other senators, and it took until 2017 for the legislature to pass the current abbreviated day program legislation.
And basically we passed a bill that said a district cannot unilaterally place a student on an abbreviated school day. And unilaterally means without the consent of a parent. That is in the bill. That if you do it, it has to go through a formal process. You have to report it as a placement so that we can keep track of where this is happening.
Tom Stenson, Deputy Legal Director for Disability Rights Oregon, is concerned that the current legislation is not doing enough, and the problem is actually getting worse.
Unfortunately, it got cut back pretty heavily. A lot of the protections, some of which are in the new bill in SB 819, some of those provisions are back because we saw that, especially with a Department of Education that really didn't want to enforce it, things actually got worse after SB 263 was passed.
Senator Gelzer Bluen also pointed out that for children on abbreviated days, It can be very difficult for parents to overturn the school's decision without significant legal and financial resources.
The idea of due process for families is very difficult to access. There are so many steps. It's incredibly complicated. The parent has the burden of proof to demonstrate that a free and appropriate public education has not been provided. But the district has publicly funded attorneys that fight families who are just trying to get things like reading instruction for their children. And they have all the records. So the deck is really stacked against students.
Although Bill 819 passed the Oregon Senate last week with unanimous bipartisan support, Senator Gelzer Bluin is now concerned about the passage of this bill through the Oregon House, where it needs to go next before it can be signed into law by Governor Kotek.
We have gotten through step one in the Senate, but we have a long way to go. And the only way that we get it done is if the voices of these students and these families are louder and clearer than the education establishment, because the education establishment is going to confuse people. They are going to make it seem like it's rare, that it's necessary, that these kids are scary. And that is simply not the case. These are not disciplinary removals. These are kids whose constitutional rights have been stripped from them when the school doors have been slammed in their faces. And that is simply not acceptable.
Bill 819 was introduced to the Oregon House today and is expected to be voted on this month. For KBOO News, this is Owen Bastable reporting.
A bill now in the Oregon legislature would allow people in prison on felony charges to vote. Proponents of the measure say it's a racial justice issue. Eric Tegedoff speaks with Alice Lundell from the Oregon Justice Resource Center to learn more.
Oregon lawmakers could restore voting rights to people currently in prison. For the third year in a row, advocates are attempting to get a bill passed to allow people who are incarcerated on felony convictions to vote. If passed, it would make Oregon the first state to do so via legislation. Alice Lundell with the Oregon Justice Resource Center says people of color and low-income people are disproportionately affected by the carceral system and thus disenfranchised.
We have an opportunity as a state to move beyond that, to take action in support of racial justice and to guarantee the right to vote to currently incarcerated Oregonians.
About 8.7% of Oregonians in prison are black, even though only 2.3% of the state's population is black. The measure would restore voting rights for about 12,000 people. Critics say people who have committed crimes such as murder or rape should not be allowed to vote. Under the measure, people would vote in the elections from the communities where they resided before being arrested. An analysis of the bill found it would cost about $800,000 to implement over the next 4 years. Lundell says the state's vote-by-mail system would make it easier to implement. She also notes that people in prison want this right back and are interested in criminal justice policies.
There are very few people in the community who are more impacted by decisions made by elected officials and by government than people who are currently in the custody of the state.
Maine and Vermont are the only states that never disenfranchised incarcerated people. Washington, D.C. has also recently restored voting rights for people in prison. Lundell notes that some incarcerated Oregonians already are allowed to vote, such as people in jail for misdemeanor charges or those waiting for a trial. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Well, it appears that scammers were very busy yesterday. The Portland Police Bureau reports that there were three separate incidents on Sunday of people being flagged down by drivers who said they were having car trouble. Once the victims got out of their own cars to help, a second person from the first vehicle stole a purse of the Good Samaritan. In the second case, the suspect stole the car of the person who stopped to help. The first fake car trouble scam took place around noon on Sunday, with a second incident about 20 minutes later. Both of those incidents involved drivers saying their cars were smoking or on fire. They happened in the area of the Central Precinct, which encompasses downtown and West Portland. The third incident took place in the East Precinct and occurred within the same hour. In that case, the suspects tried to pull in front of a driver and make them stop. That driver was able to get around the car and drive on. According to Portland police, the suspects and vehicle descriptions in all three cases are similar. Police also warn that if anyone flags you down saying they are having an issue with their vehicle, it's best to move to a safe public space before getting out. Police also ask that any suspicious activity be reported to the police non-emergency number at 503 823 3333. So it looks like the latest notable residents who will be facing eviction in Portland are the beloved Belmont Goats. Coin News reports that the Goats, who have resided in various places in the city throughout the years, were moved last week to make room for a new safe rest village for unhoused Portlanders. Luckily, that move was fairly easy, as the herd was relocated just across the street from where they've been most recently at North Syracuse Street near the Peninsula Crossing. You may recall that last month, the Goats were released by a self-proclaimed anarchist group. It was nearby unhoused campers who saved the Goats from wandering the streets. That anarchist group said they released the Goats in protest of homeless sweeps. A spokesperson for the nonprofit organization that cares for those goats said they in no way encouraged that sweep, which took place on the area where the goats were living. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, with an in-depth look at The Healing Project. It's a multimedia installation that shares stories from incarcerated people about how the trauma of imprisonment has impacted their lives and families. After that, at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, let's talk about race. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 36. Tomorrow, a 50% chance of rain with a daytime high of 47. Today in history, in 1972, American basketball player and sports analyst Shaquille O'Neal was born. Shaq is known as one of the greatest basketball players of all time. The quote of the day is from American modernist artist Georgia O'Keeffe, who died on this day in 1986. She said, quote, "I've been absolutely terrified every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing I wanted to do." Years ago, a prominent indigenous rights activist in Honduras was assassinated. Over the weekend, commemorations were held in her honor. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Commemorations were held in Honduras over the weekend to mark 7 years since the assassination of Goldman Prize-winning environmental and indigenous rights activist Berta Cáceres. Maria Martin reports that though there have been some convictions in her death, her supporters say the intellectual authors of her murder are still at large.
Berta Cáceres had fought for the rights of the indigenous Lenca people of Honduras.
No es un crimen defender nuestros propios derechos como pueblos indígenas.
It's no crime to defend our rights as indigenous people, Cáceres stated before her death, as she fought to stop a hydroelectric dam project she said would disrupt the water and food supply in Lenca communities.
Porque en ello vive el espíritu femenino.
In Lenca tradition, she said, the rivers are the home of the mother spirit and must be protected. The former head of a Honduran construction company building the controversial dam, Cáceres said a post, was found guilty last year of collaborating in her 2016 murder. Roberto Castillo was also alleged to have hired 7 hitmen previously sentenced for her killing. But Berta Cáceres' family and supporters say the intellectual authors of her murder are some of Honduras's most untouchable families and remain outside the law. And that 7 years after her murder, Honduran environmental activists remain targets. At least 4 have been killed this year alone. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
A bill that would require Montana to pay for the cost of law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation recently passed through the state Senate. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
In the 1960s, Lake County agreed to provide law enforcement services on the behalf of the state across the Flathead Reservation, but county officials earlier this year pulled out of that agreement, saying county taxpayers can no longer foot the bill, estimated at nearly $5 million annually. Senate Bill 127 would require the state to negotiate funding for law enforcement on the reservation with Lake County every other year. If the parties do not come to an agreement, the state would then be responsible for law enforcement services. Lake County commissioners and officials spoke in favor of the bill last month. They say it would be more costly for the state to hire officers and build local infrastructure than to pay the county to do the work. The legislature passed a bill last session paving the way for the state to pay Lake County for its law enforcement services, but did not appropriate any funds. The bill requiring the state to fund those services now moves to the House for consideration. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Chickasaw Nation's Cultural Center is hosting a film festival on Saturday in Sulphur, Oklahoma, to celebrate cultural renaissance through indigenous cinema. Fran Parchcorn is the Chickasaw Cultural Center's executive officer.
The film festival is important because it allows us to carry on a form of storytelling, which is important in First American traditions. We're celebrating and uplifting Native filmmakers who are working to preserve our culture. The goal of the Hope of Passauche Native Film Festival has always been to promote the art of First American cinema through cultural awareness using mass media.
Four short documentaries will be showcased, two feature-length documentaries, and the headlining film, Montford, the Chickasaw Rancher. Panel discussions and question and answer sessions with Indigenous filmmakers will follow the screenings. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
So if you use Twitter, you may have noticed there's been an uptick on the number of people praising former President Donald Trump. Well, it appears that hundreds of thousands of fake automated Twitter accounts have been busy praising the former president and attacking his opponents. The accounts were created in the last 11 months or so, and they shared overwhelmingly positive content about Trump. Those fake accounts ridiculed Trump's critics from both parties, and they've also attacked Ron DeSantis, a rival for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. They say he can't beat Trump, but that the Florida governor would be a great running mate. Bots are fake, automated accounts that become notoriously well-known, especially after Russia employed them on social media platforms to sway the 2016 election. Most bots aren't designated to persuade people, but to amplify certain content so more people see it. Until recently, most bots were easily identified, thanks to clumsy writing or account names that included nonsense words or long strings of random numbers. Modern bots are much more sophisticated, however. The bot network was uncovered by researchers at Seabra, an Israeli social media analysis firm. Seabra could not determine the identity of those behind the bots, but it did figure out it was probably created within the U.S. Those accounts feature personal photos of the alleged account holder, as well as a name. Some posted their own content, while others reposted content from real users, amplifying the effect. Many of the accounts posting the content were created on the same day. Most of those accounts are still active, though they have relatively modest numbers of followers. As an example, one account called GOP Senate Leader Mitch McConnell a traitor. He is one of several Republican critics of Trump. Twitter itself claims fewer than 5% of its active daily users are fake or spam accounts. Specific negative posts about Trump critics were more likely to be faked by bots. Nearly three-quarters of the negative posts about former Governor Nikki Haley were traced to fake accounts. The network also helped popularize a call for DeSantis to join Trump as his vice presidential running mate. That's an outcome that some on the right have championed. They say it would allow Trump to avoid a potentially difficult matchup if DeSantis enters the race. Trump's campaign has not yet commented on the mass bot allegations. On the eve of the 2023 Florida legislative session, a watchdog group is asking lawmakers to end their focus on divisive, quote, culture war issues and focus instead on passing a people's budget. It would include policies it claims will work for the people of Florida instead of, quote, tax-bucking corporations and wealthy campaign donors. Trimmel Gomes reports.
Florida's legislative session, which begins Tuesday, has already made headlines as a conservative majority pitches bills to expand gun rights, ban diversity programs, make it easier to sue the news media, and further restrict abortions. One coalition says this isn't what everyday Floridians are asking for. Ruth Moreno, with the statewide group Florida for All, says the average person is looking for the opposite of what's about to happen in Tallahassee. Moreno also wants Governor Ron DeSantis and legislative leaders to end what she sees as a corporate-driven agenda that benefits the wealthy.
We cannot get away with not paying our taxes in Florida, yet corporations in the state of Florida do all the time, right? And they don't pay their dues. So with the people's budget, it's asking the question, it's offering a platform for everyday Floridians.
Lawmakers are preparing to advance bills that would require private companies to check their employees' immigration status, along with sweeping changes to limit lawsuits against businesses. Moreno's group and others hold a virtual news conference today at 11 a.m. with their demands for a government that works for the people. The groups are calling for solutions to rising housing costs, and Moreno says they want to see an end to political interference in schools and universities, and criminal justice reform, to name a few priorities.
Culture war, the anti-protest bill, these are things that are not real issues for people, right? The real issues that are impacting folks are, is the school that my child going to well-funded.
The prospect of lawmakers curtailing their current agenda is slim as the annual session begins, which runs for 60 days. With a Republican supermajority, lawmakers have so far given every indication that they'll grant the governor's wishes to give him a broader platform for his expected 2024 presidential campaign. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
In news about our health, colorectal cancer diagnoses are increasing among people at a younger age. Health professionals advise people to get proper screenings for the cancer. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and an increase in cancer rates among people younger than 55 is highlighting the importance of screenings. A recent study found diagnoses for people younger than 55 increased from 11% in 1995 to 20% in 2019. Colorectal cancer is the second most common cancer death in the United States. Dr. John Dunn is with Kaiser Permanente, Washington.
The important thing is that because we do screening, about two-thirds of those deaths can be avoided if everyone gets screened on a regular basis.
About 150,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer in the U.S. in 2023, and about 50,000 will die. Because of the increasing prevalence among younger people, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force lowered the recommended screening age from 50 to 45 in 2021. While colonoscopies are an important screening test, Dunn says there's an easier way called a FIT kit that can be used at home. He says the process involved in getting a colonoscopy can make them next to impossible for many people.
To get someone to watch your children, to get that time off of work, to get someone to give you a ride is, in some cases, very difficult. And for those people, there's a real advantage to being able to do a home test.
Colonoscopies are typically done every 10 years, while the FIT kit tests are taken every year. With FIT kits, doctors look for microscopic blood and stool samples. Dunn says if the test is positive, people have to come in for a colonoscopy. Regardless of which method people choose, he says the best screening test is the one that gets done. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 6, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please give us a call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Michelle Coppola, and Owen Bastable. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Trimble Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, and we certainly hope that you will, please go to kboo.fm/give, or you can just text KBOO to 44321. Don't forget, this Wednesday is International Women's Day, and KBOO is featuring 24 hours of women-produced and women-focused content. You won't want to miss it. Stay tuned now for Making Contact, and have a great night.
Making contact.
Making contact.
Today on Making Contact, we bring you The Healing Project, a multimedia installation that features personal stories from those who are incarcerated and highlights the deep trauma that imprisonment has had on their lives and their loved ones. When you walk into The Healing Project at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco, you see a piano centered in the middle of a huge space, connected to three smaller rooms. There's sound coming from every direction, people's voices talking about their life experiences with prisons. There's an altar against one wall, draped with prayer beads, white candles, dried flowers, and bottles of alcohol. Above it